You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Millie Bobby Brown on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the editor's letter from Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief, with photograph by Mark Seliger. Later this year, at a time and date yet to be announced, millions of people will stop what they are doing and park themselves in front of the nearest available screen to binge the final season of Stranger Things. The series, which debuted on Netflix in 2016, is one of the streaming era's most popular shows ever, and its star, Millie Bobby Brown, has grown up on it. She was 11 when the first season started filming, a decade ago. And now she's starting a whole new chapter of life that includes husband Jake Bon Jovi, a farm, an animal rescue sanctuary, and a movie, The Electric State, directed by the Russo brothers, plus more of the delightful Enola Holmes. Photographer Solve Sonsbo captures Brown's chic side with portraits shot in New York, while Susie Esposito visits the star in her natural habitat in Georgia to learn more about how she handles the limelight from an iconic role and her dreams for what's next. Somebody cast her in a musical ASAP. During Oscar season last year, we revived an old Vanity Fair rubric, The Power and the Glamour, for a collection of portraits capturing the movers and shakers whose work, regardless of where they're based, wields influence in Hollywood, longtime faves and rising forces alike. We loved it so much that we are bringing it back with a new cast of characters photographed by Norman Jean Roy. Here's Michelle Yeoh, a cinema icon now defying gravity as a wicked villain, 2 years after winning an Academy Award for Everything Everywhere All at Once. There's fashion world darling Jonathan Anderson, whose collaborations with Luca Guadagnino defined the looks of Challengers and Queer, not to mention creating a fresh vibe for Daniel Craig. How about the trio from Smartless, seasoned actors Jason Bateman, Will Arnett, and Sean Hayes, who all turned out to have the perfect faces for podcasting, with a reported $100 million deal from SiriusXM to prove it. And Bela Bajaria, who sits atop all film and TV content at Netflix worldwide, and Issa Rae, a quadruple threat, actor, writer, producer, and now restaurateur, too, who's a model for consolidating creative power, the better to control one's destiny, my pretty. What's a current Broadway star doing in the mix? Well, it's Nicole Scherzinger, who's generated raves for her performance in that quintessential fable of Hollywood stardom, Gained and Lost, Sunset Boulevard. As Los Angeles mobilizes for recovery and rebuilding after this winter's wildfires, it's good to remember how resilient the town has always been, in large part because of the people whose creativity and energy fuel it. At the Democratic National Convention last summer, Vanity Fair special correspondent James Pogue probed the extent of the party's joy apparatus. He suspected, rightly, that brands, celebs, and constant-driven strategy, to quote one young consultant, weren't going to get Vice President Kamala Harris over the line. At an election night party at Peter Thiel's house, he knew it for sure. In his feature, Vibe Check, the result of months of reporting and conversations across the political spectrum, James assesses the state of the Democratic Party now. The critiques he elicits are as bracing as the stakes. As Congresswoman Marie Glusenkamp-Perez tells him, "You do not save democracy by running around yelling about saving democracy. You do it by demonstrating that democracy and democratic values deliver better quality of life for normal people." Now for some of the issue's contributors. Deborah Oshani, The Power and the Glamour. "In many ways, it felt like costume design," says the stylist of her approach to Vanity Fair's entertainment portfolio. "I suppose we are all engaging in some form of costume design when we choose what to project to the world. You just have to find the right note to strike so that it feels honest." Sove Sundsbo, "Thoroughly Modern Millie. I wanted to tell the story of a child star who is now a sophisticated, powerful woman, and I knew we would get along when I learned that Steven Gerrard is her favorite soccer player," says the Norway-born, London-based fashion photographer and filmmaker of Millie Bobby Brown. Michael Rydell, Second Act. The theater columnist has chronicled Broadway's behind-the-scenes drama for 23 years. He wrote the best-selling book, Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, and its sequel, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Though he thought his cameos on Smash would lead to an acting career, they did not. Brian Stauffer, Vibe Check, the California-based illustrator and exclusive poster artist for the San Francisco Opera, was struck by the notion of a political party engaged in equal parts dysfunction and delusion, he says. His work often depicts the darker side of human relations. Susie Exposito, Thoroughly Modern Millie. The smell of wet hay after rain on Millie Bobby Brown's farm was nostalgic for me, says the award-winning entertainment journalist who spent summers in her youth working at a horse camp in Florida. I admire her efforts to get back to the land. Rebecca Ford, Mask Off. Vanity Fair senior awards correspondent is a board member of the L.A. Press Club and a past Gold House A100 honoree. In addition to giving readers the inside scoop on all things award season, she oversees the Vanity's profile, featuring up-and-coming talent, like this month's interview with Benito Skinner. Mask Off by Rebecca Ford. He spent his teen years concealing his sexuality. Now Benito Skinner is mining that awkward time for art. Benito Skinner knows his way around a disguise. As his online alter ego, Benny Drama, he got famous for spoofing celebrities like Lana Del Rey and Kourtney Kardashian, while also creating original characters like Cooper, the Gen Z intern. Skinner's sharp but never cruel content was rewarded with a massive audience on YouTube and Instagram. When he began, Skinner was a Georgetown undergrad who'd grown used to wearing a different type of camouflage. Raised in Boise, Idaho, he spent much of his time and energy worrying that the whole world might discover he was gay. "I just remember the sense of doom anywhere I went," he says. But at 31, all of Skinner's masks are finally off. His new Prime Video show, Overcompensating, centers on a former high school football player who is desperately trying to fit in while struggling to accept his sexuality. Skinner didn't just create and write the series, he's also its star. "I really wanted queer people to see their experience and the complicatedness of that experience," he says. "Not that I don't think that exists, but I just feel like every time it was so much more complicated to come out than I've seen." Skinner attended Catholic school, where he realized that his love of choreography and choreographing dance routines to Oops, I Did It Again, and his obsession with Pocahontas would not be welcomed, so he buried his interest in the arts and signed up for football instead. "You're in third grade, and they're talking about sodomites being stoned to death," he says. "I'm like, I think I'm a little young for this, but I know that if I like men, I'm going to hell." While studying a film at Georgetown, Skinner began to embrace performing and making his first videos. In 2018, he hosted his first live show during the New York Comedy Festival and began performing comedy in front of audiences instead of just on the internet. He also started to write a script based on his coming out journey and his relationship with his best friends. "We've seen that relationship being very high comedy," he says, "but I feel like these women saved my life and allowed me to finally discover who I am." While making the latest version of Overcompensating, now being produced by A24 and Amazon MGM Studios, Skinner scaled back on social media videos. Being an internet star wasn't always an easy gig, especially when it meant facing comments. "It's so easy to take a critique personally," he says. "Somebody commented once that I had super dry butthole lips, and I was like, well, that will now plague me for the rest of my life." Making Overcompensating allowed Skinner to create without all the extra noise. And while the show is centered on a queer journey, it also captures the universal desire to be accepted and loved. "I feel like the villain of the show in a lot of ways is this addiction to masculinity," he says. "I think that everyone feels that, not just queer people." Now based in L.A., where he lives with his boyfriend of 8 years, Skinner hopes to continue making the show. He says he's got at least 4 seasons in his head, but also to act and work by other creators. "I have a few things I'd love to do," he says. "I'd love to play just full-on straight. Can you imagine?" Here's what's trending. Endless summer. Season is a state of mind in Wayne Thiebaud's Summer Days, in which the late artist eternalizes life's sunniest fleeting indulgences, like colorful ice cream cones, hot dogs, and bikinis. In the photos, Untitled Hot Dog 2019 is among the works featured in Wayne Thiebaud Summer Days, published by Rizzoli. The Scoop, Dior Men Hat, Frescoball Carioca Swim Shorts, Shanlu Shirt, Lipima Sunglasses, Gohar World in the Luxury Collection Nashville Candle, Fendi Men's Handbag, Dior Lip Glow and 077 Candy, Low Loafers, SVNR Earring, Miu Miu Shirt, Machete Petite Dangling Detangling Hairbrush in Ruby, Bottega Veneta Bag, Retrouvai Ring, Prada Beauty Infusion de Rhubarb Eau de Parfum, N21 by Alessandro Dell'Acqua Skirt, Chanel Camellia Futura Blush Trio, Hermes Longboard, and Hermes Cover. And this from Daisy Shaw Ellis, Baggage Claim, with photograph by David Brandon Geeting, Louis Vuitton, Petit Mall Celebration Trio, Icon Canvas Bag. From somewhere in his bag of wondrous magic tricks, Nicolas Ghesquière of Louis Vuitton rustled up this illusion of three steamer trunks, which is actually just one spectacular handbag. While this may look like an optical illusion, it's all the more a major fashion moment among an enchanting scene of miniature wares, complete with a tiny maroon sweater hanging on the corner of the wardrobe. Spellbinding. And also from Daisy Shaw Ellis, Gold Rush, with photograph by Suzanne Saraf, Salera by Anthony Vaccarello, Lulu 110M Slingback Shoes. Lulu de la Falaise, one of Yves Saint Laurent's closest friends, muses, and collaborators, was known for her exuberant wardrobe and zest for vibrant accessories. And these slick slingbacks, with extended gold pointed toes, flaunting colorful hunks of resin designed to look like gemstones, are an eccentric magpie's dream. Be it with long beaded necklaces, arms stacked with cuffs, or these sculptural heels, she and her opulent and outlandish influence live on at the French fashion house. And moving on to my stuff, Dress to Thrill. Celebrity stylist and The Period Company co-founder Carla Welch stays on the pulse with assist from Pilates and Postmates. Style File, Daily Uniform, Jeans by the Row, a well-worn loafer, Armani Men's Dress Shirts, Carvin Blazer. Sleepwear, Rose Uniaki Pajamas, an amazing gift from Greta Gerwig. Go-to shoe, Gucci loafer, little heel, slim toe. Favorite jewelry, my Anakuri rings. Style icon, Mrs. Prada, forever. On beauty, face wash, IS Clinical. Serum, IS Clinical Hydra Cool. Moisturizer, Augustinus Bader Rich Cream. Daily makeup, a little bit of Westman Atelier complexion drops and some Rode lip balm. Hairbrush, Main Addicts. Perfume, Armani Roserabi. Workout, Tracy Anderson Method and a Pilates reformer at home. Workout wear, Allo. At home, recent edition, Vintage Pottery. The unexpected, a Macy's Easter window display bunny. On the wall, an Edward Bertinsky from the Quarry series. On the table, roses with no greens from Eric Butterbaugh in any color. Or peonies in season, and I basically live in a succulent garden. Shout out to my husband's green thumb. Bedding, Tecla everything. To pen a friend, Cartier stationery. Aroma, Cedia Bralis. Pets, three adopted Rottweilers. For pleasure reading, Adrienne Marie Brown's Emergent Strategy Over and Over and Line Sheet by Lauren Sherman. Watching, can't wait for The Diplomat Season 3. listening to Chapel Roan, inspired by Every Day Alive as a Reason to Be Inspired, The Menu, Morning Cup, Iced Coffee from Laurel Canyon Cafe, Indulgent Drink, Rosé on Ice, Power Snack, a jammy boiled egg with some Maldon salt, Home-Cooked Specialty, Pasta, Takeout Order, Goop Kitchen Salmon Teriyaki Bowl, via Postmates. It's embarrassing how good it is. Vivian Manning Sheffel writes on books. No wonder. Rupert Everett reveals what's behind his new collection of short stories, A Meditation on Rejection. In the photo, Rupert Everett, photographed by Sarah Cresswell. Armed with a rapier wit, Rupert Everett is one of those rare actors who holds writing as an equivalent competency, counting Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene among his primary literary inspirations. In February, Everett returns with a brand new book, The American No, a collection of 8 short stories about rejection that breathe new life into a handful of failed star vehicle pitches that lived on in his head. I started writing in a moment of career doldrums, so that's how I got to do it, because I only really learned how to write when I was about 15. It's just so lovely and lucky to have 2 arrows to one's bow, he tells Vanity Fair. Writing doesn't come very easily to me. It's lonely and anxious because you look at the page, read a paragraph of drivel, and you're on your own with no one to help you make it better. Rehearsing a play with a group of actors is magical because all you have when you go into rehearsal is your own life as collateral. It feels sacred in the world we're in now, which is so virtual, with everybody working from home and everybody hiding behind social media, nobody speaking, nobody talking. Having surfed the ebbs and flows of showbiz for nearly 5 decades, in The American No, Everett embraces how, for both actors and writers, getting rebuffed is part of the job. You have to develop a strong hide, he says. After making his literary debut with Hello, Darling, Are You Working?, a humorous novel that Kirkus Reviews described as candide in modern drag when it was published in 1992, Everett learned that the more you read, the better the writer you are. It's the same thing for an actor. The more movies you see, the better an actor you are, he says. In the years that followed, Everett released another amusing tale, with The Hairdressers of Saint-Tropez, 1995, before focusing on his own story in the form of 3 memoirs, Red Carpets and Other Banana Skins, 2006, Vanished Years, 2012, and To the End of the World, Travels with Oscar Wilde, 2020. Despite a successful career, Everett notes that he is not exempt from moments of self-doubt or anxiety, and offers one way to cope. You have to die to the past all the time. I think that's the knack. Just not holding on to who you were last week is the easiest way through it. And Keziah Weir gives us this 6-pack, uncanny novels, hyper-real nonfiction, and more fresh reads. No fault. Haley Mudeck presents a fascinating and fraught history of marriage and divorce, offering sweeping context alongside intimate specificity from her own split from her high school sweetheart to those of writers like Audre Lorde, Elizabeth Gilbert, and Deborah Levy. Stag Dance, in 3 novellas and a novel, Tori Peters moves nimbly between scenes of a hormone-affecting pandemic and a logging camp plagued by a mysterious beast, with vivid characters ever exploring gender and connection. Published by Random House, and No Fault was published by Viking. Firstborn, Lauren Christensen details learning while pregnant of her daughter's grave chromosomal abnormality, Amid the political ramifications and devastating loss, the memoir teems with life and love, published by Penguin Press. Liquid, a Love Story. An Iranian-Indian-American adjunct studying marriage plots and seeking middle-class comfort, permanent health care, makes a strategic plan to marry rich in Mariam Rahmani's smart, addictive debut novel, published by Algonquin. The Antidote. Karen Russell conjures a surreal story of the American Dust Bowl, told from the perspectives of a prairie witch, a scarecrow, a photographer with a mystical camera, and others. It reckons with a legacy of violence and whitewashed history, published by Knopf. I'll Love You Forever, Notes from a K-Pop Fan. In layered essays, Jia Kwan fets and dissects the juggernaut genre of K-pop, from the phenomenon of fandom to the influence of particular artists, published by Holt. And Madison Reed gives us more on books. Picture this. From gripping portraiture to striking landscapes, 8 new books offer a feast for the eyes. The Art of the SNL Portrait. Revisit photographer Mary Ellen Matthews' most creative images of the show's host, published by Abrams. Hollywood Confidential. Photographer Dafydd Jones's insider snapshots go beyond the red carpets and golden statuettes, published by ACC Art Books. The Chateau Marmont Hollywood Handbook, edited by André Bellaz, owner of the Chateau Marmont, this refreshed edition of Hollywood Handbook compiles tales about the iconic Sunset Boulevard Hotel, published by Rizzoli. Secondary. Artist Matthew Barney documents a series of performances and installations that tackle the complex pageantry within American football, published by Rizzoli. David Armstrong, Fashion. Who's the Fairest of Them All? The first posthumous publication from David Armstrong answers with portraits of beauty and youth among 107 images, published by Matt Editions. Stuff. A New York Life of Cultural Chaos. Kim Haystrider, co-founder of Paper Magazine, catalogs an eccentric personal collection with this vivacious visual memoir, published by Damiani. Cargo. Richard Mizrach contemplates the impact of global trade on the environment through a painterly photographic study of stalwart ships, published by Aperture. And Vanishing, photographer Anna Arendt strikes like lightning as she unearths the history of her family in East Germany, flashes of white-hot emotions illuminating the darkness around them, published by Charcoal Press. gastronomic immunity, Washington, D.C.'s ascendant dining scene prepares to seat a second Trump administration by Nate Freeman, with opening illustration by Jorge Arevalo, showing diners in a restaurant. On a Wednesday in late November, Keith McNally, the King of New York restaurants, was somewhat improbably in the outer reaches of Washington, D.C. He was getting ready to open the world's second Minetta Tavern, some 90 years after the first one debuted in the heart of Greenwich Village, in a neighborhood that has provided much of the District of Columbia with its meats for nearly 100 years. The area, Union Market, has been building since those cool Obama years, and the last decade saw the arrival of chic pour-over purveyors and high-rise luxury apartments. The second Minetta Tavern possesses the same magic glow, backlit, clubby feel of the original, with one crucial difference. The framed pictures of the Manhattan Minetta feature artists, musicians, and stars of screen and stage. In D.C., it's all about the politicians. I knew I wanted to bring my most serious restaurant here, says McNally, who got an apartment nearby. The steakhouse is just one of the anticipated restaurants to come to the nation's capital from New York or L.A. restaurateurs in a busy and strange spell for the capital's fine dining scene. The powerful restaurateur Stephen Starr approached Nancy Silverton of La Brea Bakery fame to partner on her first East Coast restaurant in the heart of Georgetown. In 2023, Jose Andres opened a version of his The Bazaar at the Waldorf Astoria, Washington, D.C., which had settled in the old post office near the White House the year before. Kwame Onwuachi, the chef behind Tatiana at Lincoln Center, recently launched Dogon at the Salamander Hotel. All of these restaurants, years in the making, will now stare down a phenomenon unique to the District of Columbia, the quadrennial fit of unease brought on by the exit of one president and the arrival of another. Even under regular circumstances, these transitions can present vibe shifts of the highest order. And the transfer of power that took place in January after Donald Trump's non-consecutive re-election promises to be more than regular. Last time around, Trump used his Trump International Hotel as a de facto clubhouse. BLT Prime was literally the only restaurant he visited in Washington in the 4 years he was president, and he always got the same thing: shrimp cocktail, well-done steak, and fries. His Diet Coke had to be opened in front of him to prove it was free of germs. Same thing for the mini ketchup bottles, which, terrifyingly, were brought out to accompany the steak. Sometimes he got dessert, either apple pie or chocolate cake. That's all he ever ate. But the clubhouse is now the aforementioned Waldorf Astoria, and the old BLT Prime space is occupied by Andres, who had planned to take the space all the way back in 2015. Before becoming a vocal Trump critic. So Trump's inner circle may have to fan out throughout the city, which went more than 90% for Kamala Harris. That could get awkward. A server and manager at Bouchard's Saloon in Capitol Hill was fired after telling Washingtonian that she wouldn't serve Trump people if she knew them to be a sex trafficker or trying to deport millions of people. In a statement, the restaurant said her comments violated its zero-tolerance policy on discrimination. McNally, however, seemed unconcerned. He knows D.C. quite well. He spent years coming down on the Amtrak to check out the shows at the National Gallery of Art. His good friend Christopher Hitchens, the late Vanity Fair columnist, lived in the Wyoming on Columbia Road. McNally understands the D.C. mindset that usually only natives fully grasp. The town's elites generally get along in private, regardless of who's in charge or what they're saying about one another in public. Everybody has to eat dinner. McNally personally endorsed Harris and even bought cases of champagne ready to pop once the election was called for her. It's all still there, his business partner Roberto Rossini Delice says of the champagne. I really thought she was going to win, McNally says. It's not the outcome I would have wanted, but you have to move on. One upside of moving on was realizing he was opening a steakhouse just as a bunch of red meat Republicans would be coming to town. Somebody asked me what I would do if Trump came in here, McNally says, looking around at the restaurant. I said I would serve him. He's welcome to come. If anyone can survive D.C.'s restaurant whiplash, it's Starr. Born in Philly, he spent decades building out a nightlife and hospitality empire in his hometown before expanding to New York and Miami. But he always wanted to open a place in D.C. New York gets all the attention, and L.A., but this is the capital of the most powerful country in the world, Starr tells me on the phone. All kinds of shit is going on there. So people in Washington may think maybe it's a little boring, but it's not. He opened La Diplomat in April 2013, bringing legit Gallic cooking and sophistication to the fulcrum between the two Obama terms. Michelle Obama took then-President François Hollande to La Dip, as it's known to locals, in 2014. John Kerry was early on the bandwagon, as were Susan Rice and Chuck Schumer. When the Trump people came to town in 2017, they embraced it as their own, too. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump brunched there, and Newt Gingrich was a regular. EPA Chair Scott Pruitt liked it so much that at least once he took advantage of the lights and sirens of his motorcade to get down traffic-clogged 14th Street. More recently, it was one of the few D.C. spots where Joe Biden would pop in. Starr expects the restaurant will be as bustling as ever once Trump comes back to town. It's comfort food. It knows no ideology, he says. He also now has other reservation books to fill. Osteria Mazza, his collaboration with Silverton, opened in November. Weeks after the inauguration, he'll open another potential hot spot. This one just steps from the White House. Built inside the Willard Hotel, the Occidental will be a fine dining establishment designed by Ken Folk, perhaps best known for designing Carbone in Las Vegas, with its Godfather movie as dinner experience. We want to make this the place where people go to be seen to have power lunches and power dinners, Starr says. Intrigue, CIA affairs with a Russian spy, this is the narrative, this is the place. Or there's a chance things will revert to Trump 1, the president dining every night in a hotel that bears his name, the U.S. government putting up Secret Service agents in the suites alongside foreign dignitaries. We'll all once again need intro-level courses on the Emoluments Clause. In late December, Eric Trump delivered a bombshell to the New York Post. The Trump Organization was looking into getting its hotel back. Sources for the tabloid stressed that there hadn't been any negotiations as of yet, but the Waldorf Astoria is primed for a takeover. The Trump Organization sold its lease in 2022 for $375 million, making $100 million in profit. Since then, it's already changed hands. The current owners bought it at foreclosure for $100 million. Seems like a deal could be in the air. It's unclear what that would mean for Andres, whose recent opening in the hotel was supposed to have capped a 9-year odyssey. After first announcing the space in 2014, the chef told the Washington Post in July 2015 that the project was impossible after Trump's rhetoric about Mexican immigrants. The Trump family sued the chef for $10 million. Andres' company countersued, and the case was settled in 2017. While Trump's name was physically removed from the premises, to my eyes on a recent visit, the place, with its vast marble lobby, still had a tinge of Trump gaudiness. Above the restaurant's balcony, the Robert Irwin installation, 48 Shadow Planes, was still hanging in the center of the room, more than 40 years after it was installed. Irwin, who passed away in 2023, once told me that it's a hell of a good piece, and it will live on. It will outlive Trump's reign. I don't know if I'm going to make it back, but it'll be there after I'm done, and after he's done. The food at the bazaar was great. Maryland blue crab was featured in not five different tapas. But the vibe was a bit off, with fork taps echoing through a half-empty gigantic hotel lobby that still had a whiff of the 45th presidency to it. The cover story on Millie Bobby Brown is coming up in the next installment. That and more in the next podcast. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.